Raziris, thank you for your kind exaggerations. It's a treat to be here. It's a treat to be with you guys. And it's a treat to have the opportunity in particular to join Rabbi Ziering and all of you in learning Agada. One of Rabbi Ziering and my shared delights and shared interests is studying Agada seriously. The Rambam writes in his Perish on Mishnayos. Perish on Mishnayos is usually very terse. I'll give you a line or two. Just so you're able to learn the Mishnah effectively. At the end of Maseches Brachos, he suddenly has a tremendous amount to say. A very, very extensive paragraph. And at the end, he says, I'm really sorry. I know it's uncharacteristically lengthy, but I never turn down an opportunity to teach Emunah, to teach Agada. Whenever an opportunity comes my way, I'm going to seize it. I'm going to seize it because it's so valuable. I'm going to seize it because it gives us the opportunity to learn more about HaKadosh Baruch Hu and learn more about what the Rambam saw clearly as the way he structured Mishnah Torah, really the center of the Torah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu teaches us is the Chovos HaLevavos, is understanding the Ribbono Shel Olam, understanding how HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs his world, understanding the relationship that we seek to have with him that he seeks to have with us. If you've learned Ramchal's Mesilas Yesharim, so interwoven with all of it, it's a very, very multi-layered sefer. Maybe some other time we can talk some more about the life and times of that controversial clean-shaven Kabbalist, Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. But in his unassuming and exceptionally profound sefer, Mesilas Yesharim, it is at the same time a practical handbook for growth, and it's an extraordinary encyclopedia of ideas. And every once in a while, he's very subtle about it. It was in his Amsterdam period after he had gone through a lot of controversy and he had been ostracized and been kicked from town to town. He's trying to maintain a low profile in terms of some of the profundity. So Mesilas Yesharim is very unassuming sefer. Every once in a while, he'll quote an Agadata and he'll say, Re'ei kama nifla ma'amar zeh, look at how fantastic this Agadata is. L'misha ma'amik la'havinbo. For someone who takes the time to dig deeper. There's a lot to appreciate, but we need to stop, smell the coffee, and not just slide by. I want to take the next little while together to take a look at an Agada, a bit of which I think is familiar to many of us. Mm-hmm. It's from one of the great addresses of Agadata in the Talmud Bavli is Perek Chelek, which depending on what pagination you're using, is either the last or the second to last parak of Sanhedrin, either the 10th or 11th parak of Sanhedrin. The Rambam, one of the Rambam's major addresses for discussing Agada over the course of the period of Mishnayos is his introduction to Perek Chelek. That's where, most famously, at the end of the introduction, that's where he enumerates what he sees as the 13 principles of faith. That's just the end of the introduction. The beginning of the introduction is fascinating as well. Very rich. He talks about ultimate purpose. He talks about Yimosim Mashiach and Tchias HaMesim, Gan Eden, Schar Na'om HaZeh, all these different pieces fit together. He talks about human motivation, and he talks about appreciating Agadata. Chelek is already, in terms of the Mishnayos, a major address for Agada, as the Rambam makes clear, and the Bavli is incredibly rich. It is probably one of the densest, one of the most Agada-dense prakim in Shas. A lot of Agadata in general, a lot about Mashiach in particular. So I'm going to take a look at an Agada together, one that's at least the basic concept of which is pretty well known. The king that would be Mashiach. Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin Sadi Dalad, we'll start from the middle, then we'll sort of build our way out. So you see, this Agadah actually is in the center of the page. Sanhedrin Sayyidalam and Aleph. Amar Avi Tanchum, a name that's close to my heart. Darish Bar Kapara Bitsipori. Bar Kapara, who was more or less a contemporary of Yehuda HaNasi, sort of the transitional generation between the Tanam and the Amoram. See, he once gave a public shiur in the town of Tzipori in the Galil. Mifdei Makol Mem Shebeemtze Teva Pasuach Vezeh Sasum. A pasuk in Yeshayah, which we'll see presently, which strangely has a mem sofis in the middle of the word. It's always a final form. It's never initial. So why is it? This is a, a, a singularity in Tanakh. If you take a peek up top for a moment to Yeshayahu Paraktes Pasuk Vav, Lemarbeh HaMisra. You see that first word has a mem sophis in the middle of the word. What's it all about? So Rabbi Tanachum says, Bikesh HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in the second line of the central quote, Bikesh HaKadosh Baruch Hu lasses Chizkiyo Mashiach. V'sancheiv Gogu Magog. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was going to make Chizkiyo Mashiach. But then it didn't work out. They were in Zocha and he wasn't Mashiach. We'll come back to dig more deeply. But that sort of central core, the notion that Chizkiyahu HaMelech could have been Mashiach, that's something that I think many of us have come across somewhere or another. And it's a little bit like the size three tzitzis. Or like the lullaby effect. David Foreman, I imagine many of you have come across some of his books. I see some heads nodding. He calls this a lullaby effect. He says, you know, if I ask you for a free association, Rockabye Baby on the Treetop, how does it make you feel? What's the mood?
Sleepy.
Calm, right? What did I say? Ah, see, that, here's a man who's analytic. Right, so most of our associations, like, oh, it's like peaceful, it's cozy, you're safe. If you actually look at the words, I mean, right, read those words, they're horrific. The Grimm brothers were Kishmam Kain Hayu. And most of the fairy tales and lullabies that originate from that that source are actually terribly violent. It's about a parent, it's Rahman, it's son. It's a infanticide. It's a parent leaving a baby in a cradle, hanging from a tree, and then eventually the baby falls to his gruesome death. Bizarre. Now is not the time to analyze 18th, 19th century Germanic or Teutonic lullabies, but it is worth recognizing that, unless you're particularly analytic, something you came across as a child, when you weren't really thinking about things analytically, you sort of have this this association, and you stay with it unless you think beyond. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and I'd love to take a question, Rabbi Kamenetsky sort of captured this idea with maybe a little more of a positive scenario. He said, imagine the following. Imagine the following. So imagine you have a three-year-old boy. He's toil-trained, he's ready to start wearing tzitzis. So you make a tzitzis party, where I come from. You didn't have didn't make an upsharon, or not of that Hasidic tradition, but you make a tzitzis party. The kid starts wearing tzitzis for the first time. Chinuch into that mitzvah, I say. So the family comes together, some of the friends come, the kid's on, three-year-old's on a chair, he's holding that size three tzitzis with a puff paint, the mitzvah train, whatever it is, right? And everyone's there, and everyone's excited. He says the bracha, he puts it on, everyone claps, pictures, cakes, and it's a real celebration. And it should be a celebration. It's beautiful. This child is starting the mitzvah of tzitzis for the first time. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky said, but the fast forward 10, 20 years, now he's 13 or 23 or 53, still wearing that same size 3 tzitzis, which by now is choking around the neck. Well, it's pretty obvious there's nothing to celebrate. Because it's pretty obvious to us, it's self-evident that the physical aspects of our Avos Hashem need to grow with us as we grow older. It's less obvious, it's obvious that the tzitzis, I need a larger tzitzis as my body grows. It's less self-evident, but far more significant that the intellectual, spiritual, emotional elements of our Avos Hashem need to grow with us as we grow. But if I met Avraham Avinu for the first time as a five-year-old, if I met Purim for the first time as a four-year-old, or I met Shemona Esrei for the first time as a seven-year-old, so if I had that opportunity to meet these concepts as a child, so that's a blessing, with a potential cost. Because it means that I may forever sort of inertially stay with a five-year-old's understanding of Avraham Avinu, a four-year-old's understanding of Purim. Bereishis was written also for children, but it definitely wasn't written only for children. Purim is also for kids, but it's certainly not only for kids. And as David Foreman pointed out, you want to avoid that lullaby effect. When you were 5 years old, you had a five-year-old's age-appropriate understanding. But as we grow, you want to active the solution to this intellectual inertia is to actively return to ideas and actively analyze them with the new tools that we have that we didn't have as children. There was a question in the back before. Moshe?
You were mentioning a pasuk in which there is a final form of a letter inside a word.
Right.
Which pasuk is that?
Yishayahu Perek Tes Pasuk Vav, right over here, on the right side. This is the very first word in the Pasuk. L'marbe ha-misra. Yeah. What's your name?
Moshe.
Moshe. Where are you from, Moshe?
Yeah.
Tinak, okay.
If we're saying that the ideal is that people move past a simple physical relationship with mitzvos and move toward a more intellectual understanding, then wouldn't it be better if during cleanup, instead of saying, everything's like about running the tzitzis or whatever, or that we're now performing these, we're learning about basic understandings of stories and Abraham's a nice guy, shouldn't we start off by introducing the kids to basic philosophies of understanding instead of just giving them cute stories, start off with a foundation that's more intellectual so that when they grow and develop, it's not like a shock that Judaism is different than just we're doing cute little things like putting strings on our clothes.
It's an interesting question. I'm not sure that I said that. I didn't say that the goal is to move away from the physical towards the intellectual. What I was saying is that it's clear that there are physical aspects and there are intellectual aspects. They are, in fact, interwoven. I was saying that it's clear that the physical aspects of our yadas need to grow with us as we grow. Clearly, I need a larger size tzitzis
right.
As they get older. It's less self-evident, but far more significant that the intellectual and emotional and spiritual aspects need to grow with us as we grow. If I'm speaking with a five-year-old about anything, whether it's Torah or otherwise, I'm gonna give him an age-appropriate five-year-old's an accurate age-appropriate understanding of whatever it is that we're talking about. When he's 10, I can give him an accurate age-appropriate explanation for a 10-year-old.
Right.
The goal is not to misrepresent the child and then to clarify for an adult. The goal is to represent accurately to the extent that a child can understand, and then be true in Torah and any field of knowledge.
Right. So, just from a practical point of view, mm-hmm. I find that, at least in my life, very often what I was told was a simple account of stories either in Tanakh or with mitzvahs in general, and then as I got older, mm-hmm. I realized it's almost nothing like what I was told. When I was told it was one midrash that wasn't explained fully, and then I had a misrepresentation. I was given a misrepresentation of what the ideas of Chazal that we're trying to convey. So, this is less of a theoretical understanding of, okay, this is what this is how to practice, but more of how, I guess, an approach to Chena. But shouldn't it be, though, that, from the beginning, that we're taught with, okay, yeah, there are these cute stories, but this isn't the full picture. And we say that to kids, and we don't necessarily give them the full picture, because obviously they're not going to be able to understand. But when we're teaching them, we're saying, this isn't the full story, it's just predicated so that they understand almost in this
way. There's some truth to what you're saying. I don't want to get too far afield, but I would say there are different approaches to chinuch, and some I'm more comfortable with, some I'm less comfortable with. I wasn't there when you were younger. It's hard for me to comment on whatever you did or didn't hear and did or didn't absorb, what was said to you and what you did or didn't absorb as a five-year-old. But I don't know how much you've read of Piaget or of child development in general, but children aren't just little adults with smaller vocabularies. So conceptually also, you're going to need to present ideas. And the truth is that's what that Mishnah at the end of Avos, that talks about Ben Chamish LeMikra, Ben Esra LeMishnah, is capturing, and the rest of the Mishnah as well, is capturing the fact that there's cognitive development, that there's emotional development over the course of various stages of childhood into adolescence and over the stages of adulthood. So it is a little more nuanced, but yeah, you do want to present things accurately in accurate pieces that are age appropriate. Yeah, absolutely. So let's return here specifically. Let's bring all that sort of general perspective back here. So here we have an agalata. Here we have an agalata that we may have, some of us perhaps have come across in the past. Chizkiyahu should have been Mashiach. That's sort of one idea. Yeah, there was a king, Chizkiyahu. By his Rishon period, and he should have been Mashiach, but he wasn't. And as a six-year-old, you might not be able to understand much more than that, or maybe, if the adult has a more nuanced understanding of the Agalata, maybe we could present it to a six-year-old in a slightly more nuanced way as well. But let's, Baruch Hashem, we're all way past six. Let's try to dig a little more. As the Rambam writes in his introduction to Chelek, that I referenced before, he says, the same brilliant, sophisticated, nuanced Chachamim, who gave us the halachic sugyas in the Bavli, also gave us the sugyas, the agadic sugyas in the Bavli. So you got to assume that there was brilliant sophistication, new ones going there on there as well. And if I'm not seeing it, maybe I need to look a little more closely. So what's this all about? It's at first glance, it might strike us as sort of random. Oh yeah, there was a king. He could have been Mashiach, but he wasn't. What's it all about? Who's Chizkiyahu? Why does this matter? What does this mean? This is more than just a coulda, shoulda, woulda. The king who would have been. The man who would have been king. The king who would have been Mashiach. What does all this mean? So it might help, as is so often the case, to expand our sense of context a little bit. And then maybe we'll see where it takes us. So first off, who was Chizkiyahu HaMelech? Who was? I don't know how much familiarity comfort there is here with Sefer Melachim. People have seen the inside of a Sefer Melachim the last year or so? 2 years? 5 years? Okay, yeah.
So he's a king in Yehuda.
Yeah, he's a king in Yehuda. Yeah, pick it up. I'm sorry?
It's been a while.
It's been a while, okay. Fantastic. You want to pick up? What's your name?
Moshe.
Moshe.
Yeah, I was just going to say also, I mean, he got rid of a lot of Odeh Zarah, and, well, there's a whole event, how he almost died, and he had to do Shubia to, well, there's the Pshat, and there's, like, the Gemara about the fact that he didn't want to marry, the daughter of Yeshaya, because he thought he was going to have a bad son, but not which he did, but the whole point is that, oh, that's not up to him. He had to just follow the Torah and
Tarshish. Fantastic. Let's pull this all together. A lot of a great day. Let's pull this all together. As you mentioned, let's sort of put things into perspective a little bit. The story of Chumash ends. The story of Chumash is telling the unfolding, as it were, of the Brisbane of Sarim back in Parshas Lech Lecha. Kadosh Baruch Hu tells Aravinu, you will be the progenitor of Am Hashem, of Am Yisrael. And Kadosh Baruch Hu lays out a blueprint. They're going to go into Galus. They're going to emerge from Galus with not only physical Rechush, but the spiritual Rechush of Torah and Eretz Yisrael. And essentially, the rest of Chumash, certainly Shmos, Vayikra, Vamid, but Varam, is the unfolding of the Bris Ben Absarim. The descent into Mitzrayim, the emergence from Mitzrayim, the physical Rechush, Matan Torah, which is a process which begins at Har Sinai and continues over the course of the 40 years, and the march towards Eretz Yisrael. That is the drama of Chumash, in a nutshell, is the unfolding of Bris Ben Absarim. And the curtain falls, and at the end of Chumash, as though Sabrach and Moshe Rabbeinu dies, the Jews are on site, on the east bank of the Yarden, ready to cross into Eretz Yisrael. Nevi'im opens right afterwards. Moshe has passed away, Yoshua takes over, and over the course of Sefer Yoshua, and Sefer Shoftim, so we see the conquest over a couple of centuries, the conquest of Eretz Yisrael. The Shvatim are gradually spreading out. There's some national leadership, there's some localized leadership, and finally in Sefer Shmuel, there's a unification of sorts of the Shvatim, a process which begins under Shmuel and continues through Shaul to David HaMelech. And David HaMelech has the first truly united kingdom. He's the first king of the Jewish people who really rules over all the 12 Shvatim. And his son is Shlomo, and that's where Sefer Melachim opens. The death of David and the transmission to Shlomo, as Rav Yigal Ariel of Novin Chispin points out, with the course of Sefer Shmuel, of course of Shoftim, you have sort of localized leadership. Couple of Shvatim at a time. Of course, the Sefer Shmuel, you have national leadership, but no dynasties. The four leaders of the course of Sefer Shmuel, Eli, Shmuel, Shaul and David, none of them passed on the leadership in a significant way to their children. Even David does not, within the context of Sefer Shmuel, Avshalom is an abject failure. It's only in Sefer Malachim that the focus turns to dynasty. And throughout Sefer Malachim, we're going to be watching the line of Malchus Beis David. It opens with Shlomo and Sefer David's son. Sefer Malachim closes with the last of the Malchus Beis David of the Bais Rishon, Tzidkiyahu, who is a direct descendant of David, and who is the last king at the time of the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. Shlomo is told by the Navi that because of his sins, HaKadosh Baruch Hu plans to divide Bnei Yisrael into two separate political units, two separate kingdoms. And there's going to be a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. There are indications in the Tanakh that that was an earlier split, that it unified under David HaMelech. Yehuda and Yisrael, and the southern kingdom of Yehuda and northern kingdom of Yisrael, are once again going to split apart. Navi tells Shlomo, in the discuss of your father David, it's not going to happen in your lifetime, but your son will only inherit the reign of the southern part of Eretz Yisrael, the Kachava. But Navi appoints Yeravam ben Nevat, to the leadership of the northern kingdom. Rechavam ben Shlomo is the leader of the southern kingdom. And so it goes for a couple of centuries. And as you learn Sefer Malachim, one of the fascinating features of Sefer Malachim is that it's split screen in a very organized, methodical way. It'll say, okay, then the next king was Rechavam ben Shlomo. And you have a parak or two, or a couple of psukim, whatever it is, about Rechavam. And then you say, okay, then end that paragraph. Now let's talk about the parallel king in Israel. He took over when Rechavam was up. They have it, and it goes back and forth and back and forth in parallel, watching the kings of Yehuda and the kings of Israel, kings of Yehuda in the south, the Malchus Beis David. That is a stable dynasty. The kings of Yisrael in the north, Aseres HaShvatim, it's marked by incredible lack of dynasty, an incredible lack of continuity. Every once in a while, you'll have a run of two or three generations. Often, it's from coup to coup to coup. There's very little continuity in the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom is riven throughout pretty consistently by violence and by Avodah Zarah, rampant. Sometimes rampant and state-sponsored Avodah Zarah, rampant and often state-sponsored violence. The ten Shvatim, we hear about the lost ten tribes, they are essentially the northern kingdom. Because one of the political developments, general, international political developments, that we're watching as Sefer Malachim progresses, is the rise of superpowers. There's a rise, towards the end of Sefer Malachim, we're watching empires build, and empires fight with each other. The first major empire to impact Eretz Yisrael is the Assyrian Empire, and subsequently we're watching the rise of the incursion by Egypt, and finally the incursion by Babel. Babel ultimately destroyed the first base of Mikdash. Ashur, Assyria, comes and is threatening, and for a couple of years, decades, they've been threatening and imposing their power. Ultimately, after a series of visits, shall we say, by the Assyrian Empire, they destroy Malchus Yisrael. The northern kingdom is wiped out. One of the vicious techniques, empire-building techniques that Assyria had was the following. Profoundly Machiavellian, not in the court, but on the ground. If you're building an empire, a major issue when you build an empire is, how do you maintain, as your territory grows, it becomes harder and harder to maintain hegemony over the whole area. That's a problem with that. It's a problem, political science problem, for any would-be emperor. The Assyrians had a particularly vicious solution. Their solution was mass migration. Mm-hmm. We're just going to let people, we're going to colonize an area, let them live there, they may want to rebel. So they practice mass migration. They're moving people by the probably hundreds of thousands, maybe millions. They would conquer a country and move them out. Conquer this country and move them out. And that's how we end up with the 10 lost tribes, Aseres HaShvatim, because Ashur comes, conquers the northern kingdom, and moves out Malchus Yisrael elsewhere. Moves in people from a different colony known as Kusa, Kaf of Taf Aleph. And they are known as the Kusim. You hear about the Kusim throughout the literature of Chazal. They were a people who were brought in, to Eretz Yisrael. The Tanakh says there was some sort of spotty gerus that they underwent at some point, and the halachic quality of that gerus is an open question. Okay, Assyria then comes back. Now they're back for next. Now they're back for the southern kingdom. Syria comes back to the southern kingdom, and as you mentioned, Sancheriv comes and he's eating countries for breakfast. He's destroying country after country after country, and he's menacing Eretz Yehuda, and he in fact demolishes most of Eretz Yehuda. He conquers, he sacks tens of cities, and even lays siege to Yerushalayim. It's fascinating. Professor Tadmor, who was an Assyriologist a number of decades ago, pointed out the external archaeological record for the miracle that's told in the Tanakh. Tanakh tells us that you mentioned the parallel Navi, the primary Navi during the period of Chizkiyahu was Yishayahu HaNavi. Yishayahu tells Chizkiyah, it's frightening. Yishayahu, they've decimated most of the Eretz Yehuda, and they've laid siege to Yerushalayim. They're taunting the Jews, and Chizkiyahu sends a message to Yishayahu, this fantastic back and forth. Yishayahu says, the Kodesh Baruch Hu told me you're going to be fine. You're going to be fine, and it's going to be a miracle. And in fact, it is. And the Tanakh tells us, they wake up the next morning, the Piyutim tells us it was Pesach morning. They wake up the next morning. The army is dead. Sancheriv flees. So Professor Tadmor pointed out a number of decades ago that if you look at the military annals of Sancheriv that were excavated in cuneiform, if you piece together what's going on there, even he needs to admit that something went on. Because he says, I destroyed this country, I destroyed that country, destroyed this country, destroyed that country. So then it says, I came to Eretz Yehuda, and I destroyed this city and that city and this city and that city. I even destroyed Lachish, which was probably the second largest city in Yehuda at the time, after Yerushalayim. And I laid siege to Yerushalayim. And I had Chizkiyahu in my palm of my hand, Sancheriv writes, or Sancheriv's scribe writes, like a bird in a cage. End of paragraph. What he obviously didn't say is, I destroyed them. Because only Jews are so honest that we speak of our failures in our records. The Syrians weren't doing that. But he wouldn't absolutely lie. But the glare, the omission, the lacuna, the fact that he says, I laid siege, I destroyed, 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 came to Jerusalem, I laid siege, mechal hein atoshem e'alav, it's reflecting the miracle that's told in Tanakh. So that, as you said, that's the story of Chizkiyahu. As you mentioned, Chizkiyahu was spiritually a revolution for the Jews. His father had been an incredible Rasha. His son and grandson were also an incredible Rasha. And his great-grandson would return to his moral clarity. His great-grandson Yishayahu, as a footnote, Yoshiyahu would be the last sovereign king of the Jewish people. After Yoshiyahu dies in the military encounter with Mitzrayim at Megiddo, and that is the end of the sovereignty of the Jewish people. I mentioned that there were already superpowers that were seeking to take over. Ashur does not succeed at the time of Chizkiyahu in overpowering Malchus Yehuda, but then his great-grandson Yoshiyahu is, after Yoshiyahu dies, that's the end of a sovereign Jewish nation. There will not again be Jewish sovereignty in Eretz Israel until the days of the Hashmonam, the middle of the second Beis HaMikdash period. The last couple of kings of the Jews, all descendants of Yoshiyahu, I mentioned before, Tzidkiyah, the last of the kings, the time of the Churban Beis HaMikdash, Yechaniah is another name that should be familiar from the Megillah, all the descendants of Yoshiyahu, they're just puppet kings. It becomes essentially a vassal state, first of Bavel, first of Mitzrayim, and then of Bavel, and that's the context of Chizkiyahu HaMelech. A man of extraordinary bitachon, as the Tanakh stresses, and a man who inhabits this spot in history. Now let's take a look again at that Gemara. So Mitzanher and Saridalad. L'marbe ha-Misrael l'shalom ekeitz. Once again, Mitzanher and Saridalad in the middle of the page. The first thing we need to have appreciated is, who is this Chizkiyahu? Now we're ready to dig a little more. L'marbe ha-Misrael l'shalom ekeitz. That Gemara is opening with this pasuk here in Yishayahu Tesva. Al Kisei, the pasuk says, Kisei David val mamachto lahachinosa olasaadab mishpat. Yishayahu is talking about the strengthening, the revitalization, and the rooting, the strong rooting of Malchus Beis David. A reference, apparently, Chizkiyahu HaMelech. So Amar Rabbi Tanchum, Darsh Bar Kapara B'Tzipori, once again, but Bar Kapara, in the public shir in Tzipori, said, well, why is the men, L'mar Beis HaMisra, talking about the revitalization of the reign of Chizkiyah and the reign of Malchus Beis David in general under Chizkiyahu, presumably specifically a reference to this particular episode. Excuse me. That appears in Yishayahu Lamed Zayin. Why, or in, I believe, Malachim Beis Perek Ches is a parallel parak. Why is this episode of Chizkiyahu's miraculous survival in the face of the Assyrian siege? So why is there that closed men? Any mem in the middle of a word is open. This one is closed. Because the Rabbi Tanchum called Bar Kapara is saying the following: B'keisha Kadosh Baruch Hu, let's take a closer look. B'keisha Kadosh Baruch Hu lasses Chizkiyahu Melech v'sancheirav Gog u'Magog. Kadosh Baruch Hu wanted to make Chizkiyahu Mashiach. Excuse me, to lasses Chizkiyahu Mashiach to make sancheirav into Gog and Magog. But Amar Midas Hadinus Min Kadosh Baruch Hu. But the problem was, he wasn't deserving. How so? David Melech Yisrael Shamar Kamashirish Vishish Bachos Lo Asiso Mashiach. Chizkiyahu had all these Nisim Lo Amashir Lefanecha Taaseu Mashiach Lechein Nistatem. He didn't say Halal. He didn't say Shira. That's why it's closed. His mouth, that the significance, the graphical significance of the closed mem is that he was closed when he should have been open. His mouth should have been open to say Shira. Presumably, you had this Yeshua. You should have been saved. So let's take a look at three concepts in these few lines. One is Gog Magog. One is the lack of Halal, which we'll talk about briefly, and then finally we'll talk about Chizkiyahu and Mashiach. Number one, what's this with Gog Magog? Chizkiyahu should have been Mashiach, and Sancheirav should have been Gog Magog. So maybe we've heard that also sort of float in the ether. Mechem is Gog Magog. What's it all about? So that comes from on the top left of the Mar Makomo sheet, Yecheskel Perek Lamed Ches. This is a part of what part of this is what we read as Avtar for Shabbos Chol HaMoed. Yecheskel delivers a nevuah discussing a man named Gog, who's the king of Magog, and what he describes is a final war over the status of Yerushalayim. He describes Magog leading non-Jews in fighting against Yerushalayim, and there's a pitched battle, an eschatological pitched battle over who owns Yerushalayim, and he prophesies there'll be plenty of countries coming, particularly from the north. Here you see Pasuk Tezvav. Pasuk Yud, Komar Hashem Elokim, Vayomahu Ya'alu Dvar Malavavecha, Gog, Yecheskel says in the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's going to be this day when you're going to think that you can attack Yerushalayim. Elal Eretz Perazos Avo Ashkatim Yoshvei Vetach. I'm going to attack this peaceful land of Israel. L'chein Hinavei Ben Adam Amarta L'Gog. So Yecheskel says to Gog, that's not going to work. Vatan Mekomei, you come from the north, you're going to attack. You have a lot of military power, but it's not going to work. V'eskadilti v'eskadishti v'arati le'nei goyim rabim. That will be the Jewish success in the war against Gog, king of Magog, will be the ultimate expression of clarity about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that will usher in, Yecheskel goes on to say, the era of Mashiach. When we talk about Gog and Magog, it's this war over the status of Yerushalayim that's going to precede, that will herald the coming of Mashiach. At the time of when the Scud missiles were flying a couple of decades ago, there were a great Tamei Chachamim who wondered whether this was Melchemes Gog u'Magog. Perhaps Mashiach was coming. Turned out not to be the case. Over the course of the Six-Day War, that also looked like, that was absolutely a battle between the Jews and the Ummus HaOlam, who owns Yerushalayim. Who owns Yerushalayim? There was many were wondering, is that indeed Melchemes Gog u'Magog? So the Gemara in Sanhedrin is saying, that nevuah of Yecheskel, that could have been Sancheirav. Sancheirav came from the north. he had tried to attack Yerushalayim, he was miraculously repelled. That could have been, he could have been Gog, he could have been Gog, king of Magog. Apparently the assumption is that Magog is not the actual name of a country. Magog is a reference. So it could have been Sancheirif. Chizkiyahu in that case would have been Mashiach. Okay, so now we have understand concept number one. What's the Gog and Magog? I don't want to dwell too much on the hollow. That could be a whole separate conversation. I want to get to the concept number three, the Mashiach piece. But I will say the following. Let's relate to something that's also at the intersection of Halacha and Haggadah. The Gemara in several places discusses which days on the Jewish calendar call for Hallel and which don't. Which Yom Tov do and which don't. The Gemara says you have a series of days that some things say Hallel because it's a Yom Tov. The Gemara works hard to explain why we say Hallel every day of Sukkot and Shavuos, but not every day of Pesach. Then the Gemara seems to indicate in Erechin and in Megillah, and then there's a whole other layer. Sometimes we're not saying Hallel because it's Yom Tov, we're saying Hallel because of the Nes, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu saved us. And that's why we say Hallel on Hanukkah. The Gemara says it's not Yom Tov in the full sense, but we say Hallel because of the Nes, because of the Yeshua. The Gemara says, hey, one second. If we say Hallel on Hanukkah, which day on the Jewish calendar is parallel to Hanukkah but does not have Hallel? Hanukkah goes together with? Shabbos and Purim, right? So Shabbos is sort of a category in its own, which the Gemara discusses as well. But the Gemara says, well, how about Purim? No, Purim was also an ace. Purim was also incredibly Yeshua. So the Gemara gives three answers. So one answer is that the Purim does have a howl also, but instead of the standard howl, it's the Megillah. The Megillah is the howl. The Meiri even goes so far as to say, if you don't have a Megillah, maybe you should say howl. And that presumably for another time, but that sounds like we're saying that howl speaks about open Nisim, and the Megillah is a Purim specific howl that speaks instead to HaKadosh Baruch Hu working behind the scenes. The Gemara has two other answers as well. The Gemara says, either you say Purim does have a howl, but the howl is in a unique form, unique Purim edition called Megillas Esther, or the other two answers, Purim does not have a howl. Why not? The two Zionist answers. The Gemara says, either because we only say howl on a nace that happened in Eretz Yisrael, like Hanukkah, and I might add, like 48 and 67, Yom HaTzmut, Yom HaShoah, as opposed to Purim, where the Nes occurred in Chutzlar, the Nes occurred in Persia. Or the Gemara says, another difference, another distinction, is that we say Hallel on Hanukkah, because Hanukkah was not only, not that Kadosh Baruch Hu save us, but it resulted in Jewish sovereignty. As I mentioned before, the end of Jewish sovereignty, the first commonwealth was the death of Yoshio near the end of the Bais Rishon, the return of Jewish sovereignty. The Jews come back and build the second base of Mitzvah, but they're not a free people. They're part of the Persian Empire. They get permission from Cyrus, from Koresh, to return to Eretz Israel to build the base of Mitzvah, but they're not a free people. And then Alexander conquers the Persian Empire, and then we come under the reign of the Greeks, and that evolves, till they get to Antiochus, who was part of the Syrian, the Seleucid segment of what had been Alexander's larger Greek empire, as we talk about Yevanim or Syrian Greeks. And when the Hashmonaim rebel successfully and establish a Jewish country once again in Eretz Israel, Jewish sovereignty, that's the beginning of the Second Commonwealth. So the Gemara says, Purim, we were saved, but as the Gemara puts it, Akati Avdi Dachashver Shanan. We were safe, but we weren't free. We were still under Achashverosh's empire, as opposed to Hanukkah, which resulted not only in safety but in freedom, in sovereignty. In other words, it's worth appreciating what the Gemara is saying. And the Gemara is saying, look, you could make the argument that Purim doesn't have a hallel also, but it's a different flavor. But focusing on the other two answers, the Gemara is saying you only say hallel in a particular type of episode. It's not just that Kadosh Baruch Hu saved us, but that what it happens in Eretz Yisrael. And or it results in Jewish sovereignty. I would suggest what that means, in a nutshell, is that we say Hallel on, yeah?
Sukkot didn't necessarily happen.
Correct. Okay, very good, right? Sukkot did not, there was no Geula. That's what the Gemara had said, there's sort of the two separate tracks for Hallel. Either you're saying Hallel because of Simchas Yom Tov, or you're saying Hallel because of the Nes. So the Gemara says, Pesach Shavuos Sukkos, that's on the Yom Tov track. That's an expression of Simchas Yom Tov. Rabban discussed that at some length in his comments in Sefer HaMitzvos. Discussion whether that's Daraisa or Drabbanon, but it's an expression of Simchas Yom Tov. Right? So that's sort of one one driver, potential driver for Hal. But Chanukah and Purim aren't part of Simchas Yom Tov. Hal and Purim would be potentially because of the Nes. The Gemara says we differentiate between Chanukah and Purim. We differentiate between Chanukah and Purim because what? Chanukah is in Eretz Yisrael. Chanukah results in Jewish sovereignty as opposed to Purim. That's in Chutz Laaretz. Purim is safety but not sovereignty. In other words, I would suggest, but the Gemara perhaps is saying with those two answers, is that we don't say Hallel merely because of Yeshua. We say Hallel when there is not only Yeshua, but Geula. It's happening in Eretz Yisrael. It's not only safety, but it's the restoration of Jewish sovereignty in Eretz Yisrael. That's not only HaKadosh Baruch Hu saving us, it's not only Yeshua, that's Geula. The restoration of Jewish sovereignty in Eretz Yisrael, that's cause for Hallel. If you take that concept, which appears to, sort of that theme that appears to emerge from the halakhic details of when do we say Hallel, when do we not, and you plug that Gemara in Erechin and Megillah about the difference between Purim and Chanukah back into this Agadah here in Sanhedrin, begin to appreciate concept number two. Again, we said there seems like there are three concepts that we're looking at here in this Agadah. We gave a little bit of the background. Number one was Gog and Magog, and number two is the Hallel. So there's more to say about Hallel, but at least for now, if you appreciate from the halachic conversation, if you think thematically, axiologically, about the halachic conversation about Hallel, and it seems like we're saying Hallel is about Geula as opposed to just Yeshua, so you begin to understand the role that Hallel plays here. Chizkiyahu did experience Geula. It was, number one, from a technical standpoint, they weren't only saved, but they were saved in Eretz Yisrael, Yerushalayim no less, and it was, they were at the edge of losing Jewish sovereignty, as indeed we see three generations later. That's already what Assyria a generation earlier had done to the northern kingdom. It's what would happen a couple generations later, even to the southern kingdom, with the death of Yoshio. It's what was about to happen had HaKadosh Baruch Hu not miraculously stopped Sennacherib and his army in their tracks. So this was in Eretz Yisrael. It was not only safety for individual Jews, but the preservation of Jewish sovereignty. This is not only Yeshua, it's Geula. And as such, it calls for Hallel. This was a Chanukah moment. This was a 1967-1948 moment. This was in Yeshua in Eretz Yisrael that's resulting in Jewish sovereignty. This should have had a Hallel. And we begin to understand also why the lack of Hallel, Gemara and Sota speaks of the concept of Mida Keneged Mida, that Kadosh Baruch Hu responds to us in kind. So if there isn't an appreciation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's role in bringing Geula, it's not surprising that the Geula will not be completed. But there could have been Geula here. So the themes begin to coalesce. Yeah, question.
When in your definition of Geula, are you saying that it's that Jews are united in Eretz Yisrael, or is it as a step in the process of Mashiach, or of...
We'll talk about that more in a moment. Right. I'm not saying that anytime Jews are sovereign in Eretz Yisrael, that is Geula Shalema. I am not saying that. We're going to dig into that in a moment. Yeah, question? Or stretch? Stretch. Fantastic. Okay. So far, where have we been, and where are we going? So far, we saw this Gemara Sanhedrin Sadi Dalad, a line of which has that perhaps lullaby effect. Yeah, someone says, Chizkiyahu was this king who could have been Mashiach. The king who would have been, what does it really mean? So first we sort of appreciated a little bit of Agadah in general, specifically the need to dig deeper with analytic tools that we now have access to that we might not have had access to when we were younger. We began to look at this Gemara Sanhedrin Sayyidah more carefully. And we know it's three concepts. And so far we spoke about two. We'll wrap it up with the key third. Number one, we got some background on what Gog and Magog is all about. The concept is rooted in Yecheskel Lamed Ches, Lamed Tes. That's the very end of the middle of Yecheskel. From Mem and on, Yecheskel is a virtual reality, Nevuah prophecy of the Bais HaShlishi, fascinating. That's sort of like the last segment of Yecheskel. This is right before that, the last concept before Yecheskel has a prophetic tour of the architecture of the Bais HaShlishi and the layout of the land during the Bais HaShlishi. Right before that is what's going to come right before that. Right before the Bais HaShlishi, right before the restoration of Old Tal Shvatim, Gog u'Magog. This war between Bnei Yisrael and Umos Ha'olam over the status of Yerushalayim. So that's what the Gemara is saying. Sancheriv could have been Gog Melech Magog. We understand that it didn't happen because the closed men, his mouth was closed when it should have been open. He should have responded to this Geula with Shira of the sort, as the Gemara stresses, that his great-grandfather David had done throughout his life. David had a rough life. David had great moments. He had many, 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 many struggles. And throughout his life, Tehillim is full of David HaMelech Shiros at great moments and at difficult moments. Chizkiyahu, when the Tanakh introduces him, Chizkiyahu is identified as being very connected to the traditions of his great-grandfather, very connected not only genealogically, but the bitachon and the closeness and the richness of emotional connection to HaKadosh Baruch that David HaMelech had. But at this point, the Gemara says, but he fell short here. He didn't sufficiently plug in to his inner David in response to this nace. If there would have been proper Hallel, in response, again, to this Geula, maybe things would have been different. But finally, the Mashiach piece. What do you mean Chizkia could have been Mashiach? Again, it doesn't seem quite as random as when we began. We began with, it seems so random, Chizkia, Mashiach, what's the connection? We appreciate this, not just that Chizkia was a descendant of David and Shlomo who happened to be king. A lot of the stories align well. The story of Gog and Magog certainly aligns well. But there's even more. And you, David, Moshe, what's your name, Ron? Moshe. Moshe had wondered, well, you talk about Geula and Hallel, is this Geula, is this not Geula, what's going on? So now let's wrap everything together. Take a look back at the first source on this page. When Yeshayahu tells, and this appears both in Yeshayahu and in Malachim, those parallel prakim, Chizkiyahu reaches out to Yeshayahu, says, what's going to be? They're massing at the gates where it looks like we're going to be destroyed. First Yeshayahu sends a brief message, a couple of sentences, you're going to be fine, it's all going to work out. And then then Chizkiyahu comes, he davens in the Beis HaMikdash, and then Yeshayahu sends a much longer Yeshayahu-style, rich, poetically rich nevuah. And finally, at the end, he speaks poetically to Chizkiyah, he speaks to Sancheriv, and then finally, at the closing line, and here it's the first source on the page, Yeshayahu Lamed Zayin Pasuk Lamed Hey, V'ganos Yal Ir Hazos. Yeshayahu speaks in the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I will protect the city. They will not enter. I will protect, V'ganos is related to the word Magain. I will protect the city. L'hoshia, I will save it. L'ma'ani u'l'man David Avdi. For my sake and for the sake of my servant David. For my sake, that means that if you take a look at the context there, Sancheir had been verbally abusive vis-a-vis HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He had compared HaKadosh Baruch Hu to the gods, lowercase g, of all the surrounding nations who had not protected their countries, countries that had been totally overrun by Sancheir. And Sancheir taunts the Jews, your god is no different than the other gods, their gods didn't protect them, your god, Yudkei Vavkei, is not going to protect you, I'm going to eat you for lunch the way I ate everyone else for lunch. So there was incredible Chilul Hashem. When Chizkiyahu goes to Beis HaMikdash to daven, his focus is on the Chilul Hashem. So that's what Yeshayahu says here. Number one, I'm going to protect the city Lama'ani. There's going to be a Kiddush Hashem. You're going to see that Kiddush Baruch was for real. But number two was Laman David Avdi. I'm going to protect the city for the sake of David. What does that mean? For the sake of David. So that's an intriguing hint. That this is more than just about Chizkiyahu. This is Chizkiyahu as a figure that represents Malchus Beis David. Something about Malchus, something large with Malchus Beis David is at work in the Yeshua of Kalal Yisrael, in the Nes of the miraculous destruction of Sancheir's army. So if you look earlier, the psukim that follow L'marbe HaMisra Yeshayahu Perek Tes, if you look at the next parak, the end of the 10th parak, if you have a Tanakh, feel free to open. If not, some of it appears in the bottom right of this page. The end of parak Yud, going into parak Yud Aleph, Yeshayahu is speaking to the rising Assyrian power. Ho Yashur Shevet Api! He speaks to Ashur, who's HaKadosh Baruch, the stick of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's anger. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will use Ashur as a vehicle to visit destruction where he wants to. That language, by the way, if you remember a generation or two earlier, when Yonah had been initially unwilling to prophesy to Nineveh, which at the time was the capital of what was not yet an international superpower, Ashur, the Mechilta explains the reason why Yonah didn't want to fulfill his mission was because I don't want to be the Jew who preserves Ashur long enough that they can serve as Shevet Apo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I don't know, indirectly want to be the vehicle for Ashur to survive and thrive and rise to the point where they can destroy the Aseret HaShvatim. That language, Shevet Apo, that's exactly what Yishayahu uses a generation or two later. Ashur is Shevet Api. But he says, Ashur, if you get cocky, things are going to change. And it's a beautiful Yishayahu style image. Hayispa'er garzen al achotzev bo. There's a tool. Imagine a carpenter is working and the screwdriver, the drill, thinks that he made this. Imagine the character in the book thinking that he wrote the book. Imagine the figure in the painting thinking that he or she created that portrait. It's absurd. Shayo says, Tashur, you're a tool in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hands. If you confuse the tool with the wielder, you've got this all wrong. And he says, when that happens, you're gonna begin to disintegrate. B'yamahu lo yosif od Sha'ar Yisrael. There's gonna be a point once you cross that Rubicon, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says through Yishayahu to Ashur, once you cross that theological Rubicon, you think that you're the power here. At that point, you're gonna begin to disintegrate. And indeed, that is what happens. Ko'amar Hashem Tzvakos, Al Tirah Mi Yoshev Tzion. This is familiar. He's speaking to the Jewish people. Ashur will not destroy you. Keep reading and tell me if you recognize the last few psukim of this passage. They might sound familiar from a different time of the year. These are springtime psukim for us. You see Pasuk Lamed Beis, the end of Perek Yud, flowing into Pasuk Perek Aleph. Ora yom benov lamod. That's the sound for Jews who live in Chutz La'aretz. That's the sound of the Haftar of the eighth day of Pesach. And many of us associate Ora yom benov lamod, that Haftarah, we associate those psukim with Yom Atzmaut. Because these are psukim, the end of this parsha, flowing into Perek Yud Aleph, speak not only of the Jewish people being saved from Ashur, but ultimate geula. This is Perek Yud Aleph is the Perek of Mashiach. It describes the coming of Mashiach. V'yatza choter migeza Yishai, neitzim yishar shav Yifre, a sprout coming forth, and he describes a miraculous King Mashiach. So Yishayahu earlier is already describing that there's going to be Yeshua from Ashur, which does indeed happen, that's Chizkiyahu, and there's potential for a next step. Can we look at a pasuk though? V'yatza choter migeza Yishai. The Malbin on this pasuk, the first pasuk in Perek Yud Aleph, the end, the very bottom of the right, bottom right corner. V'yatza choter migeza Yishai. A sprout from the trunk of Yishai. V'netzer mishar shav Yifreh. And there'll be a sprout growing from the roots. So the Malbim wonders about the duality here. So it seems, you're talking about, you know, the tree has been destroyed and it's going to regrow. They've had that in the past in the backyard, or you take it in a nature walk, you see a tree that was cut down or a tree that came down because of a storm, and sometimes there's new growth coming out. And that's how Yishayahu is poetically described in the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph. Malbim's Beis Dava disappears, but Mashiach will grow back. That new sprout from where a tree used to grow, it's growing once again. The Malbim wonders, though, why the pair of images? A choter growing from the geza, from the trunk, from a stump, or netzer mishar hashav, or something growing out of roots. The Malbim says something absolutely fascinating. And now Moshe, we come directly to talk about Mashiach. Now, yeah, question. What's your name, by the way? Yeah, wow. Do you only admit Talmidim whose name is Moshe?
It feels like that.
Wow, okay. Some of you are like Rambam-style Moshe, some are Ramban-style Moshe. Yeah, take it away.
I just want to ask
Moshe, that's a great point. That's an amazing point. I never thought of that. Moshe, it's an amazing point. This, that the imagery of Yeshayahu of growth, specifically plant growth, is a semach dover after meir satzmiach. The opening image. Sorry?
The Rambam put this as the source text for that bracha.
Really? Wow. How about that? Wow. Mechavim to the Avod Ram. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. That's amazing. So, but what's with the duality? What's with the pair of terms? Growth, regrowth from a stump or regrowth from roots? So the Malbim says we need to talk about Mashiach a little bit. Now we need to get to the heart of the subject. Fast forward four blocks. Adopt Tzadi Dal, Adopt Tzadi Ches. And fast forward in Yishayahu to Perek Sabah. The Haftar of Parshat Kisabah. Yishayahu is one of the seven Haftaras of Geula. Yishayahu, what for us is the end of the Haftarah, the close of Perek Samach, two words, Be'ita Achishena. The Gemara says, Yishayahu says, I'm going to rush Mashiach on time. Got that? How do you rush on time? Either on time or you have schedule. You can't be ahead of schedule and on time. As well, they say 3 o'clock because they really meant you should show up at 3:20, but the guy actually showed up at 3 o'clock, so he was early and on time. That's not the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu rolls. So what do you mean? Either it's Be'ita or it's Achishena. Says the Gemara, Sahem Daf Tzadi Ches. Take a look at the bottom left. See, Be'itach, Hishani, Shayo, Samach, Chavez, and below, Amor of Alexandri. Rav Alexandri, a relatively rare Amora, quotes the name of Rabbi Yoshua Ben Levi, a very common Amora. He had a stira, but not a stira between Mishnayos, a stira between Sukkim. This very stira, Ksiv, Be'itach, Uksiv, Achishana. And the one that Yishayo describes Mashiach as coming on schedule, and then he describes as coming out of schedule. And Yeshua will give the answer. Depends. If we deserve, if we earn Mashiach, he'll come out of schedule. If we don't earn Mashiach, he'll come on time. In other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling us that I'm planning to bring Mashiach. Mashiach is coming. If we earn it, he didn't come earlier. But there's an end date for this stage of Olam Hazeh. The way Rav Shailat and others presented that most of Mashiach is not Olam Hazeh, most of Mashiach is the perfected state of Olam Hazeh, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu has determined that Olam Hazeh will ultimately come to its perfected state. Whether we like it or not, whether we bring it or not, but we could earn it. If we earn it, it'll come as soon as we earn it. If not, it'll come at the maximum ending. When you talk about the Kates, a latest time for Mashiach to come, that's rooted in this pasuk in Yeshayah and this Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Ita, Yeshayahu told us there's a time by which Mashiach comes. If we deserve, if we earn, it'll come as soon as we earn it. The Gemara goes on to say that there's another stira. The stira not only about what quantitative stira about when, but qualitative stira about how. Will the coming of Mashiach be a totally miraculous process, or will it be a slow, natural evolution? And the Gemara, that steer between the Zechariah, Ani Veruch HaVachamor, sounds very natural. Daniel talks about flying out of the sky. Which one will it be? The Gemara says, same thing. Zachu, totally miraculous. Lo Zachu, natural. And we're going to get to Mashiach, whether we deserve it or not. Kadosh Baruch Hu will bring us there anyhow. But if we're not Zachu, then it'll be a slow, natural process that will finally evolve into Melech HaMashiach. The end point is the same. The end, final destination, either way, is the same. Is the glory of a flesh and blood descendant of David and Shlomo, who will be king of the Jews in Eretz Yisrael, with all that the Rambam describes in the closing prakim of Mishnah Torah, in terms of diplomatic peace, in terms of spiritual satisfaction, and so on and so forth. The end point is the same, but how we get there, there are two routes. If we're Zocha, then as soon as we're Zocha, Mashiach comes instantly with total miracles. Razzle dazzle. If not, Mashiach comes anyways, despite us, if not because of us, but with a slow evolutionary process, natural process, that leads to Mashiach finally coming at the last possible moment. I'll say just personally, that when you look at the modern history of Israel, so it's a little bittersweet in the sense that in looking at it through the lens of this Gemara, it's bittersweet in the sense that it looks like we haven't been Zocha. We've been watching the wheels of Geula gradually turning. We're watching a natural political process unfold. So the rise of the notion of nation state and European nationalism in 19th century Europe, and you, or towards the end of 19th century, the natural movement towards gradually a notion of political Zionism, and gradually, step by step, and so we have a state, miracles, but also a natural process, and gradually something that feels like it's painfully slow, moving, gradually, unfurling and evolving towards what looks like Be'ita. When we talk about Schalta de Gula, that's based on looking at modern Jewish history through the lens of this Gemara. And it is a little bittersweet, because it looks like Lo Zachinu. It looks like Mashiach looks like he's coming despite us. And the wheels of Gula have been turning very, very slowly. Gradually, many of the Nevuos have been fulfilled, or are being fulfilled. They're unfolding before our eyes. And it's incredibly exciting, at the same time a little bittersweet. Lo Zachinu, and yet we are dancing the Rebbe Akiva as we see more and more positive gulas unfold before our eyes. And the Malbim says, that's what's going on here. He says, Yishayahu is describing not only in Perek Samach, but in Perek Yud Aleph as well. He's describing the two models of what the process of Bias HaMashiach could look like. V'yotza Choter Migeza Yishai V'netzim Yishar Shav Yifreh. Either new growth growing out of a stump or new growth growing out of roots. What do those capture? So there's a latest time for Mashiach to come. That is Be'ita. Apparently that time is sometime after today, because Mashiach hasn't yet come, unless he comes sometime after right now, maybe this afternoon, or maybe some later point. What was the earliest time that Mashiach could have come? There is some debate. But the Malbim says, the debate in the Bavli Sanhedrin, the debate in Yerushalmi Tainus. But the Malbim says, let's think, what was the earliest time there could have been a Gula Shleima? Historically, the earliest time was after some sort of Gullus. What was the first time that the Jews come into Eretz Yisrael brought to Eretz Yisrael to enter it again, brought to Eretz Yisrael by Moshe Rabbeinu, brought into Eretz Yisrael under Yahushua, and things gradually build until there's a Malchus. Malchus Beis David now exists. And then it begins to dwindle, right? After the death of Shlomo, we said before, it splits. You only have Rechavam is in the Rechavam only has Malchus Yehuda, Malchus Yisrael is in the north. But they are extant countries for several hundred years. And now, after several hundred years, Malchus Yisrael is laid waste by Ashur. And then Ashur comes and lays waste to most of Malchus Yehuda as well. The first possible moment that there could have been a notion of Geula was right now. It's the first Churban. The very first king that could have been Mashiach was Chizkiyahu HaMelech. That was the first opportunity. It was the first Churban after Moshe and Yehoshua. So the Malbim says that's exactly what Yishayahu was saying. Because the imagery of new growth coming out of roots, or new growth coming out of a stump means there's still something there. And what could have been, what's the Gemara saying? What could have been is continuity. There was a Churban going on in the days of Chizkiyahu. If Mashiach would have come right then, Zachu, as the Gemara says, the first moment that we had the opportunity to be Zochu to Geula was in the days of Chizkiyahu. Churban had begun to occur. There was still an element of Malchus Beis David. Chizkiyahu was king. His kingdom was rapidly shrinking, but he wasn't gone. And that was the first moment that could have been Zachu Achishana. Zachu with total miracle. And indeed, there were fantastic miracles going on right outside the gates of Yerushalayim. And that was the first moment that they could have been Zochen. Had that been, that would have been Geza Michoter Yisha. It would have been something growing out of a stump. It's not even gone. There would have been a continuity of Malchus Beis David from David. It would be a little dip, but not totally gone. Straight into Chizkiyahu Melech HaMashiach. That's that imagery of a Yatzachotem Geza Yisha. Yishayahu is saying, there's another option. V'neitzim Yisharu Shav Yifreh. Alternatively, if we're not Zocha soon enough, Malchus Beis David will dwindle and ultimately disappear. And there's nothing left. You know, when a if you invite if you hire a gardener or an arborist to remove a tree, there are different models of how they remove a tree. Sometimes they cut it down to the stump, but they leave a couple of inches above the ground. But sometimes, depending on what the tree is and what the need is, they'll cut all the way into the soil and remove from below the soil as well. And all that remains are some roots under the soil. There is no above ground stump. Those are the two images of Yeshayahu. If Chizkiyahu would have been Zoch at the very first possible moment of Geula, then that would have been Geza Michoter. That would be, excuse me, Choter Migeza. That would have been the stump, lowered, but still there, and then regrowth. Alternatively, Lozachino, so dwindles, till Machiz Beis Davar is gone. Like removal of the stump all the way down under the soil. What Yeshayahu is saying is it's not gone. It's dormant, but it's latent. Below ground, the roots are there. Below ground, the roots have been there for thousands of years. And whether we perhaps still have the chance to hasten things through our own zechus, or whether lo nizkeh and it's be'ita, what Yeshayahu is saying is that fundamentally the process is the same. Fundamentally, Malchus Beis Davar survives as a concept, and the regrowth of Mashiach Ben David is a continuation of something that looked like it was gone, but in fact was dormant, latent, roots below the ground, still there, waiting to resprout. And so now we plug it back into where we began, and with this we wrap up. What's the Gemara saying? Chizkiyahu could have been Mashiach. Could have, would have, should have. I mean, it's where we began. Seems like a could have, would have, should have. What's the point? The point is, number one, that's not random at all. That was the very first moment in Jewish history that there could have been a Geula. And Yeshayahu tells us later, as the Gemara says in Tzadiches, that Geula is a sliding scale. If we're Zoche, it comes. We're not Zoche, it comes eventually. But we can be Zoche as quickly as possible, or wait longer, or ultimately, it comes despite us. Chizkiyahu was the earliest time it could have come. That would have looked like total continuity. Yeshayahu tells us in Perek Aleph, it's still the same thing. Chizkiyahu could have been Mashiach. He missed the chance to be Mehalel. He missed the chance to recognize it's not Mir Yeshua, but Geula. As a result, he's not Mashiach. But what's going to happen sooner or later, ultimately, because of us or despite us, will be fundamentally the same thing. The trunk is no longer visible, but the roots remain. No matter when Mashiach comes, it's fundamentally a continuity of David and of Chizkiyahu. And perhaps, the practical aspect for us to think about is not only that we began to appreciate Agadah and to appreciate the nuance, the brilliance, the sophistication of Agadah, and that once you re'ekama niflam ayim rezeh, to borrow the language of the Ramchal, Mishama miklavimbo, you need some context, you need to put the pieces together, but also perhaps specifically, it means that the message of Sanhedrin Tzadidala, the closed mem, is relevant forever. It's relevant to us as well, because we're still, Chizkiyahu is dormant, but the concept, when Mashiach comes, it will be fundamentally the same thing, which means part of what we need to work on, many, many drushas are given about what we need to work on to bring Mashiach, and many of them are true. What the Gemara here is highlighting is the need to be Mehalel, the need to notice HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our lives, and the need to sing Hallel when HaKadosh Baruch Hu saves us. And that's a key piece. Midah keneged midah, the more we notice the partial Geula in our lives, partial Geula, the more we, midah keneged midah, can evoke the wheels of Geula turning ever more quickly, bringing us ever more quickly, whether Zachinu or Lo Zachinu, to Geula Shalema. Rabbos, I want to thank you so much for your patience. I want to thank you so much for your involvement. I hope you enjoyed. And I want to thank Rabbi Ziering and Rabbi
Sklar
and the Holy Shir for hosting. And I look forward to more opportunities to learn Torah together. Hatzlacha Rabba Chevra.
Thank you, Rabbi Cohn.